I thought would be really ideal.
Lucky, do you know he's gone with a dozen girls? And the only reason I like most of them, some I like more than others, they weren't political enough for him.
But he's pretty apolitical.
Very political. You don't know what time he's putting in now in this new movement. He works very hard at it.
Oh, he's involved in them now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh, yes. Very much involved. Always have been.
Huh. I wasn't aware of that.
Yes.
Well, I think it'd be a terrible...
You see, the thing is that when he went to Tulane, when he got a scholarship, a fellowship from the health and... Of course, Gardner was still there, and he was a very different guy at the head of it and everything. Then when he came to Tulane, after he was there already, they tried to take it away from him, saying that he was a member of the Communist Party, because they had tried here to come right while he was at school. They came from the CIA to question him and everything. So the dean, see, he is a marvelous teacher. So the most of the professors there got up a fund to keep to supply that because they took away his fellowship.
Oh.
So they did, but the dean is the only one who really was very anti-communist. He said, "You are a member of the Communist Party." He said, "No, I have never been a member of the Communist Party." He said, "Well, your mother." He said, "Now, one thing I want to stop you before you go any further. You don't know my mother, and I do. And I will not tolerate you to say one word against my mother, because she's working for a kind of a society that will protect even you, Dean, whether you realize it or not. And I will not permit you." He says, "Well, do you agree with your mother?" He says, "Absolutely." "Do you agree with her philosophy?" 100%. "Do you agree with her political ideas?" "Absolutely." So he never evaded it. He never flaunted it, but never, and at the student union movement, when they went, he was with them all the time, you know. So he never denied it, but it never has seemed to have hurt his view. You know, here, look, he's working at a Catholic university, and the head of his department is a head Jesuit. I said, "Do you like the professor?" He said, "Of course not." I said, "What does he talk about?" He said, "He doesn't talk about religion."
Well, I think it'd be very interesting to see the three generations.
But you see why with him? You see, when he was so young, his mother was in the prison most of the time. So he began to have it. He began reading when he was 5 years old, but not 18 months, but 5 years old. And he began reading the encyclopedia. And he would call me, "Grandma, did you know this? Did you know that?" And really, it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So he read, he was an omnivorous reader, you know, and read with understanding and question.
Well, I think it'd be fascinating to have a picture of the three generations.
And yet, you see, he has a certain arrogance. For instance, one of the girls that he had gone with that I really liked the best of all, but she wasn't political enough for him, but she's now a professor of anthropology, and she had gone to... the jungles there, when the floods were, she would have been destroyed. She got branches together and floated down the river or she'd have been drowned. And I like her very, very much, you know. So then I was up at Berkeley. She is married now to a guy called Patrick, who makes her a much better husband than Vicky would. And I was invited there for dinner, and I met Patrick's brother and his sister-in-law. And we all agreed about religion, we agreed about history and everything. And I just had loved it, and I love Sheila. So when Ricky took me home, I said, "It'd be just wonderful when to find these people who agreed with me, so perhaps that's why." And he said, "Yes, but when they agree with you, remember they went to the university, and they have a foundation that you don't have for your..." And I thought to myself, "Now, isn't it funny? They agree with everything, but I didn't get it from the university. I got it myself." But in his arrogance, he begins to think if you don't have the university, then, you know, your knowledge isn't as important, even though your reactions and your understanding of it is the same as theirs, but it isn't as important because you didn't have the stamp of the university on it. And I'll have to rub his nose in that. I don't think he's even aware of it. But isn't there a certain arrogance in there?
Yeah.
No?
Barbara, what I want to deal with today is first going back again before you left Colorado. And then the 1920s. That's my plan for today. But what I want to start with is, after the Palmer Raid, the party went underground.
More or less.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did that actually mean in terms of your group in Denver?
Well, it means that when the party goes underground, of course, there's a certain terror about things, you know. You can't, you are always afraid, you know, of losing a job, which is one of the most horrible of all things, and of going to jail. But because the prison system is very different now than what it was at that time. At that time, they did use the what they call the third degree, you know, and there was real torture in those things, you know. There's no question of somebody tortured more than... I remember when Dorothy was at the Imperial Valley when she was in prison there for 6 months, and when I went to see her with another friend of mine, and she told us that an insane woman had been in the same cell with him, and I went to the authorities and I said, look, what do you do about that? He said, we have no other place to put him. We have no... I said, but look, she can kill her. She said, well, you know, we have plenty of burial space. Yeah.
So it was the fear of imprisonment. But how did your group function once it went underground?
Well, they have meetings. We'd have never call anybody up and talk over the telephone. We'd have meetings where you had to, by word of mouth, tell anyone this and this is going to be a meeting. And you see, the experience I had, you never were too sure. A guy who was a chemist at the University of California, he was still a senior. He came over to see me once. He said, you know, you've always struck me as a little bit more honest than most of the communists I know. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, they tell me that they want me to join. They tell me there's a secret cell that nobody can find out anything about it. And I said, well, the reason you came to me is that you have a doubt of it. And you have good reason to doubt it, because whoever is telling you that are liars. The reason is just saying, look at the spies that have come out that said that they've been in the party for 13, 14 years, and all the time they were acting for the Department of Justice. So how can that be possible? I said, I think that's absolutely disreputable for anyone to try to bring you in the feeling that you're safe. I said, tell me, would you be worried if they found out that you were sympathetic to communism, not only that you were a member? Would that hurt your career? He said it would destroy it. It would destroy it all, you know. This was in the early 30s, you know, mm-hmm. 1931, 32. Mm-hmm. I said, then you have no business belonging. Mm-hmm. He said, see, you're the first communist I've met that told me I had no business to belong. The others told me, look, when you're a revolutionist, you can't stop to think about that. Mm-hmm. I said, I think you have to stop to think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Not only that, you have certain duties to your own family because you brought, that family is connected with you. I said, I want to tell you something that happened with me when they asked me to go and do certain things, and my youngest son, this same Carol Jane's mother, was only a year old. I said, no, I can't do that. I have no one to leave the baby with. But there were other children besides yours. I said, but I didn't bring the others to the world. But I did bring her. And I cannot think that I'm doing anything for them by neglecting my own. My first duty is to her, because there's no one else. And I learned to say no.
Going back before that, to Colorado, when the party went underground, so you would find out about meetings just by word of mouth.
That's right.
But
it never went entirely underground. Mm-hmm. You see, they did have meetings. But the time they went underground, and I thought that was the most stupid thing of all, is when they had in New York City the 11 communists, and the 11 communists, there was an 80,000 bond on them, and the government took it over because they ran away, and and they went underground.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was the most stupid thing I ever heard of anyone do. So I said to Dorothy, Dorothy, I know they know a lot more than I do in many things, but they don't have any common sense. And I have more common sense than she says, what do you mean? I said, now what the hell will they do if they're scattered all over? Right now, with the means of communication and everything, nobody can stay long on it. So they can't be underground all the time. Someone will write a letter, someone will do something, that they'll be recognized. What do they think they'll do? Well, but they're afraid of fascism coming and they can't let the... Well, I said, how are they going to prevent fascism by going to be scattered all over there? They're going to govern by remote control? I said, I never heard of anything so stupid. $80,000 is gone.
Now, was this in 1950 when the party went
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right.
Now,
and I thought
earlier,
it was stupid.
Did you think after the Pomerantz going underground was a good idea?
I thought you had to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you had to be very careful. But I thought you were the only ones you ever fooled were yourselves. I don't think they always had means of finding out.
Mm-hmm.
How could you keep a thing so secret? If you wanted to talk to anybody, how did you know who you were talking to? How did you know that they had changed? Here I told you about the secretary of the Socialist
mm-hmm.
Party, who was a school teacher all the time, and I knew him for so many years and trusted him implicitly. And yet he was a stool pigeon for the Department of Justice.
Well, Barbara, did that sort of thing lead to a real general state of mistrust? Since there were, after that experience was implemented.
No, I don't think it did. You see, that's another thing, too, that I didn't think they were vigilant enough. They accepted anyone, especially from a minority group, too readily without any question. I thought that they were not vigilant enough.
I see, in who they initially brought in then.
That's right. That's
because
right.
I understood that right after the Pomerantz, when the party went underground, that one of the things that they did was no new member could come in unless two other people knew them. Was that true? Like in Denver.
Well, someone had to recommend them.
Mm-hmm.
But what did that mean? What did that really mean when you, the last analysis, that someone recommended, two people had to recommend that they... And the party had a vote on it, whether they accepted them. But does that mean that you knew any more about them than the very fact that there were stool pigeons who came out and testified some after 10 years in the party?
Mm-hmm.
And when I spoke to Dorothy about that, Dorothy said, well, the thing is that they were, the very fact that they were, they had to do certain things, that no matter what. I said, but what they did, if they had to do certain things, But they imperiled all the others. What did that amount to? I said, there was and they did accept a great many. I know we had one group here that, well, it wasn't a group. It was a man and his wife. She was a very lovely person. We thought she was. He was a lewd, obscene person. For instance, he liked to talk about sex in a way that made you vomit. For instance, If you can't have a man, use a carrot. You know, things like that. And I hear the poetry he wrote, you know. And he had known all the time. See, he brought a lot of people into parties. He'd go down to the Grand Central and he'd say to the, especially to the Negroes, look, I'm a member of the Communist Party. You need it more than I do. So if I am a member, why don't you join and help your, you'll help your race, you know. And he brought people in, but they stayed at the three meetings and then left. So when they said, look what Herbert has done, I said, but Herbert don't stay in, do they? So when I told Dorothy, I showed her the poetry that Herbert, she says, Mama has nothing to do with him because he's a pervert and we want nothing to do with anyone like that. And I think, see, he was always borrowing money. And the only reason, the most he ever borrowed from me was $10. And the only reason I got it back is that when I began to be suspicious of him, I went down to see the chairman, a dentist. He was the chairman of the party. I went down and told him all about him. He said, don't let him know when the meetings take place. They're very close to you. They live just a few blocks from me, I said. Tashin, his name was. And he said, don't let them know where the prayer meetings are or anything. Just simply ignore them, no matter what. And I think that in order for them to find out, they would come and they said, look, we don't know where and everything. I said, well, for the time being, we're kind of laying low because I couldn't tell it. So I got back my money. But many people who had given them so much and everything, and he was a member
now
of the...
This was in L.A. in the 30s.
Yes, yes, it was in the late 30s.
Well, in Denver, you had this group of 40 people, but when the party went underground and reorganized, did you break up into smaller groups?
Yes.
How did you do...
Well, you see, before we found out that there should not be in any group more than about 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then anything that one observed carefully, you know, and everything. See, one of the things I found out about this same thing, she was very active in the ILD.
Mm-hmm.
But she did, you know, there were many wealthy people who gave beautiful clothes, and she would take cartons of clothes down to her house for her children. And then I found the dog was around. Then, you know, she would take the biggest pile of the leaflets to distribute. And when I went over to the house and she told me to hang, I don't know why she trusted me, she said, hang your coat in that closet. I found stacks of them right there. Mm-hmm. They were never distributed and everything. So I reported that to Passion.
How would you decide, for instance, especially early in Denver, what did you do about bringing in new people? How would you decide if it was safe or not?
Well, you see, one of the things is, if we were suspicious of anything we had and everything, then we'd have a meeting and discuss it. And we knew that we couldn't let them know where meetings were. They were eased out. And then when it was very flagrant, we came right out and told them that, they had voted them out of the party.
But so your group of 40 then broke down into groups of 6, is that it, remember?
No, 6 at the most, at the very most, and that was already the largest, was 10.
And then how did the groups communicate with each other?
We never had meetings in meeting places, mm-hmm. you know, because I told you we used to use the Turner Hall, and it was only in people's homes, and more or less people that we knew we could trust. Or at least we felt we could. As far as I can remember, none of those people with whom we met, but they had come in from the Socialist Party into that team. And most of us knew them. I remember them very slightly. You see, we left Denver in 1921, and the party was pretty young at that time.
Well, but look how, in these small groups then, what you weren't able to organize, really. It was more of a study.
Yes, we did. We would organize a campaign to write letters.
I see.
And if they gave us credit for intelligence enough to write letters, just as if we were doing according to the Constitution, not as radical, you know, and everything. And we were very careful. And then you see, another thing that helped a whole lot there was the forums that were operated. And one of the forums that operated, they had David Starr Jordan, they had Jane Addams, they had speakers like that who did speak out and tell many things that were happening, you know, and they really had a tremendous influence. Most of them were operating under the Methodist Church.
I see.
You know.
So all of you would go to the forums?
Oh, a great many of us went to forums. And we were supposed, if there was something that was going to be said, we were supposed to let anyone know that this is important. Talk to people that you know. See, now, for instance, with me, I made friends. I became very close friends with all the teachers of my children, with all the teachers. And you'd be surprised how little they knew of these things. And when I would tell them, you know, of what was happening, they were always very receptive. I only found one teacher who said she wanted nothing to do with anything and didn't want to hear anything, but yet nevertheless she never reported anything or anything, but she didn't want to have anything to do with it. But she said that the Constitution was good enough for her and that's all she needed, and she didn't have any. But I brought in many of the teachers, became very sympathetic and helped us, you know. And so I remember
most
when
of your, most of your activities, though, in, before you left Denver, then became more the small group who would write letters.
Well, yes, and then we helped in the union organization, you know, to help organize unions. Most of our activities then were devoted more to that, because although you know very well that they killed the workers who were trying to hurt. Ford had killed four of them. They killed the, but nevertheless, you could get a more sympathetic group to that. You could get
people. Well, once you were underground, did you still try going to the industries and leaflets?
Yes, yes, we did. And we also had, we did issue leaflets. But you see, what we had to do was each one had as many leaflets as he thought in that 20 minutes that he could distribute. And we dispersed as soon as they, as they were passed out. And we went to generally to union meetings and to, for instance, the like the dairy thing here, the Arden Dairy here. I remembered, and this was already in 1934, I think it was. No, it was more, it was in the 1940s. I couldn't leave Ricky, and Carol Jean came over. And at that time, I think she was about 19. And she said, what were you doing? I said, I'm supposed to go, but if I have no one to leave Ricky with, and I don't like to go alone anyway. She said, well, I'll take the leaflets and distribute them. I said, but I have no one to go with you. She said, I don't need anyone to distribute leaflets. You know, she was very successful about it. And I'll tell you, when she said that, when, for instance, there was a young man who was going into Arden, and she, he said, no. She said, but some other time, perhaps, she said, maybe one organizing time.
Well,
he stopped by and said, well, yes, I'm sorry. He said, but you see, I have to be very careful. They search us. And he said, you understand that I have nothing against it. I'm all for it. But I have to search it and everything.
Well, in Colorado then, in say 1920, when you would go around with the leaflets, what name would you issue them in? Or you wouldn't put, would you put the Communist Party?
No, in the name of the union, generally.
I see.
Organize. If you want success, you must organize, and that was the thing.
So it was just a general leaflet, and
that's right.
There was never an identification on it.
No, not at that time.
Because
at that time it was really a little too dangerous.
Now, in these, once you, in Denver, you broke up into these smaller groups then.
That's right.
But here you had known all the 40 people earlier. Did you still keep in touch with each other, or did the group really
Well, you see, when we came to California after Carol Jean was born, I wasn't active in the Communist Party at all until 1936, because I wouldn't leave her alone. You know, that I always... See, many parents felt very, very bad because their children were turned against them and would have nothing. Now, mine didn't, but I never neglected my children because of it. Nor did I ever insist that they belong to anything. I said, these are the things that you want to do, you do it. But I never said, you join this. And when Frances left the party when she was only 21, because of something Darcy did, I never was I never got angry at her. Maybe I said, if you think that that these things are going on, and that rather than being of benefit, they're jeopardized people, then you do whatever your conscience says. And she did.
Well, Barbara, what year? Bernard is the oldest, right?
Yes, Bernard is the oldest.
What year was he? He's
60. He was born. He's six. He was just 65, November the 22nd.
So he was born 1909.
Yes.
And then Dorothy was born in 1914.
Yes.
And then was Frances next?
Frances was born in 1911. She's next to Bernard.
Oh, I see. And then Carol Jean was born in
1925.
Okay, I see. Now, before you left Denver then, you had the three children. And Dorothy was the youngest, so she was only 7 years old when you left.
That's right.
Now, before you left, you left in November of 21?
November the 7th, we left Denver, November the 17th, 1921.
Mm-hmm. Now, what, from the time of your joining first the Socialist Party, then the Communist Party, when did your husband change his occupation and start traveling so much? When was that?
He came about, when Dorothy, I think, was just about a year old when he did. So 1915.
So that was about the time that you had joined the
Socialist Party.
1915,
yes. 1914,
1915. Uh-huh. And then, with this job, he traveled all the time?
Well, he traveled, yes. He traveled most of the time. He was gone 7 weeks and was only home 12 days.
And he traveled all around the country?
Well, most of it in the western part of the country. Uh-huh. Well, he went as far as Montana, though.
Now, what was your life like during this time? You were home alone with the children and most of the time.
Yes,
what was it like then?
Well, it wasn't easy because, for one thing, I was always inclined to be scared. You see, I think I told you that when I was only 9 and a half years old, we had come to Los Angeles, and my mother had sent me to the grocery store to get some yeast, and I had the yeast in my hand when a young man stopped me and said, "Little girl, would you like to earn some money?" Did I tell you that?
No.
I said, "Well, how can I earn any money? I'm only a little girl." He said, "Well, I'm telling you, I'm making aprons to pick little girls like you who can't afford a very pretty little apron, and I will give you 5 cents for each apron I try on you." I said, "You mean you're going to give me money for just trying that thing on me?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Oh, what a good man you are. What a..." He said, "Well, come with me," and he took my hand, but by the time we came up to a little hill just about a block from our home, I began to get scared of him. He was holding my hand so and looking down at me in such a way. I didn't know anything about rape. I didn't know a thing about anything like that and everything. And suddenly he grabbed hold of me on top of the hill there and tried to... See, at that time we wore panties with buttons. So he tried to pull my... So then I got so scared, I bit his hand, and then he said, "Oh, you little devil, you." And he tried to grab hold of me, but I bit his hand and began to run as if the devil were running after me. And I ran, and I didn't leave him, you know. When I came home, I was crying like everything. My mother said, "What happened?" I said, "A man said he would give me money to the trial, and he wanted to kill me. I never knew about rape." I said, "He wanted to kill me, and I don't know why. He wanted to..." Well, my brother, who was 6 years older than I, he went ahead and slapped me because he understood what. So my father, who was unemployed, he was walking around. My brother went out and said, "Go and sit, listen to your sister." And he told him what he said, "And you slapped her? Don't you know what would have happened to her? She doesn't know anything. She doesn't understand what it is." He says, "Shame on you." So my father came in and he said, "Don't cry, don't cry. Only remember, never go with anyone you don't know or anything else like that." But it left a terrible feeling with me. I was absolutely terrified. If I heard anyone walking behind me, I would just freeze with fear. And I hated being alone. So, but I had no choice. I tried living with my mother-in-law and father-in-law for about 6 months. I had to do all the washing. We had no washing machine. And his bloody handkerchief made me vomit my insides out. So I said, told Joe, I said, "Look, I hate to be alone, Joe, but I can't live with your parents." I did all the work. And my mother-in-law, who was even shorter than I am, so you know what the shrimp she was. She was a wonderful cook, but she was a lazy little thing, you know. She
wasn't. Did he ever think of giving up that job because it kept him away so much?
No, because there was nothing else he could do. You see, he had very little choice about it. And you see, he died in 1930, and already the Depression was already nearing, where the sales were, you know. I often wondered, you see, he sold to the, the big cheese and the Kraft wanted to, that's the time when John Kraft was, and he met Harry Hoffman and John Kraft at the same time, and John Kraft said, "Stick with me, Joe, and you won't be sorry." And if he had, it would have been much better for him. But Harry said, "Look, they're both Jews. Why don't you come with us?" And so Joe went with them, and things were getting very, very bad. And so I'd often say to him, when they got things from Italy, these gorgonzola, these fancy, I said, "Joe, how do you sell these things? And they're selling at such a high price." He said, "You come along with me and you'll see. I never lie. We've been married 22 years when he died. I never heard that man, never once did I hear him lie. I told him once, I don't think we'd have symptoms to lie." So I went in with him, you know what? And he said to the man, "Look, you are the epicure. You're the one who knows all about this. You know, I sell it, but I really don't know what you know. I leave it to you to tell me what it is. I think they're charging too much. What do you think of it?" "Yeah, Joe, you don't understand what this is. This is really, it has that indefinable taste and everything." He said, "Put me down for, they never took very much, a few pounds and everything." But Joe had to walk sometimes for 2 miles to get a bus to go at Great Falls, Montana, Red Bluff, Montana. No. At that time, not very many people did drive. It was the train most of the time.
Well, how did this affect your social life and your
It didn't really have much effect on my social life. He was very worried. He didn't want me to be active at the party. He believed in it, but he didn't want me to be active. So he would say, "You know, you're not even through the marks." Mark said, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains." But you have something to lose. You have a nice home, and your son is at college. Your older daughter is at the high school. And he said, "You have nothing." I said, "Joe, I'm only in advance for 2 months. If 2 months you were out of work, your pants were already beginning to be. We have no money. It's all you earn." And he was never a big earner. I said, "Goes to pay the bills. So I'm only in advance of your being, what Mark said, you have nothing to lose with your chain, of 2 months in advance. Because it would take less than 2 months for you to be out on the street," which was true.
Well, now, Barbara, how much was he earning at that time? Do you recall how much he
bring
home a week?
I think the most that I can remember that he ever earned was $50 or $60 a week.
And then he'd send it back to you?
Oh, yes.
So most of your social life revolved around the party then?
Oh, yes.
Because that must have been a fairly lonely life.
But in California, as I say, until 1936, when I went back into the party, I had taken out a leave of absence because I wouldn't leave my baby alone. So most of my activity was in the ILD, the International Labor Center.
Well, tell me how you decided to move out to California.
Well, Dorothy was the one who had chilblains, and she was sick. She was a sickly child all the time. And Helen had died, I told her, my oldest child. And Helen died. Now, she was really a remarkable child. Now, she began to read very early, and she had such broad sympathies. She was only 4 years and 7 months when she died, and she was sorry for the neighbor because I told her, really, and it seemed when Helen died, it seemed as if her life died then. So, even then, you know, we used to go to the, most of it, I didn't join the Socialist Party until 1915.
Right.
So, it was, what was her name? Kate Richards O'Hare.
We talked about that before. I was wondering then what brought you to California?
Well, Dorothy's health, yes. She's when I was 9 and a half years old, I told you we had been in California. And to me, I had to always remember it with all the orange trees, all of this place were all orange orchards. You know, now it's so changed you hardly see them. But everything. You could buy a whole bucket of oranges for 10 cents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had even gone around peddling with a little 9.5 years old, but no one, you know, going around there, you had pins and needles, mm-hmm. and safety pins and things like that. And I sold more. And my brother tried. My brother was 16 and I was 9.5. So I sold more, you know, but I didn't like it. But I just think of the risk I ran, you know, going into places, into saloons and everything. I wasn't afraid of anybody in spite of the thing, you know. The only thing I was scared of is to be alone at night or if I heard footsteps behind me. That terrified me.
Well, so the idea of coming to California was that the weather was so much nicer, is that it?
Oh, yes. Yes, the weather was nice. There in Denver gets very cold, and we have snow, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had remembered how warm it was here and everything, and I always remembered it as a kind of a paradise.
Oh, I see.
I've always loved California.
So you sold your house in Denver then?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how did Joe feel about moving out here?
Oh, he didn't mind.
Was that going to mean that he was going
to... It didn't make any difference according to his work where he lived.
And it didn't
he worked out of Chicago.
Oh, I see. So, but initially then, you came to Los Angeles.
Now, we came here. It was after Dorothy's health. But Dorothy, you see, began to be active in the attics. I told you when she was only 6 years old, when she called after those, you dirty scab, you ain't you ashamed of yourself, you scabs?
But why did you only stay for 6 months, Barbara?
Huh?
You only stayed in Los Angeles for 6 months the first time, you said.
Because my father couldn't get a Stella.
No, when you came back out here with the children.
When I came back here with the children, no, you stayed in Los Angeles. Then when he got had changed from, selling this, and my friend that I had taught her English and everything, she was married to one of the Schweders from the Samson Luggage. They gave him to a job as Oakland was supposed, he was supposed to work in Oakland, so we went up to Oakland.
Oh,
then.
I see. Well, how long did you stay in Los Angeles then? Just a year?
At that time, the first time, we stayed here only about a year.
Oh, I see.
And then we didn't come back here until 1930 when he died.
Now, oh, so when you went up to Oakland, did that mean he was going to now live at home, or was he still traveling?
No, he still traveled, but now that he was home a little bit more than, because some of the territory he had was in California. With the cheese, it was mostly out of California.
Now, when you came to L.A. in 1921, did you make contacts with anyone in the party then? When you first came to Los Angeles?
No, because I had taken out a leave of absence from the party.
I see.
But I still was active in the, at that time there wasn't even an ILD, you know. The ILD, I think, came out in 1927, I think.
Well, how about the Workers' Party? You weren't involved with them?
No. But I did go always in there. Wherever they were organized for unions and everything, I went.
Mm-hmm.
The picket line.
Wait, let me get Los Angeles, then you didn't make any, when you first came here in 21, then you didn't make any contacts with any.
Not within
party
the party,
people.
No.
Well, who were your friends then, since your whole life had been?
Well, most of my friends were the people who were socially minded. But most of them were either people that, some of my friends in Denver, you know, and they were all socially minded, and some of them were party people, but I wouldn't become active in it because I said that I couldn't leave my child.
Uh-huh.
And they tried to get me to do it. That's when I learned to say no. Before that, I would accept any task, no matter, you know, what infuriated me too, when they used to send Dorothy, when she was only 12 years old, you know, in such dangerous parts of Oakland, you know, and everything. It was really dangerous. No concern for a kid, you know, in anything like that. It could have happened. They said, well, you can't. What about the people who live there? You're concerned only about her. What about the people that live there? I said, well, I can't help that, but I can try to protect her. And it was dangerous.
Well, so Barbara, you didn't go to meetings or anything then in the early 20s in Los Angeles?
Well, whenever they called for picketing for anything, I went.
Mm-hmm.
Always. Because, you know, I could leave in the daytime. I could leave Carol Jean with the older kid. Bernard was 15 years older than Carol Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis was 14 years older than Carol Jean.
Oh.
But so for picketing, I never refused to go and mm-hmm. help picket or distribute leaflets. I distributed, in spite of the fact that I wasn't active in it, I distributed leaflets in our neighborhood. Of course, I tried to distribute so they wouldn't know to, so at night or, you know, very quickly. But I never refused to carry out anything that I could do or to write letters. I used, now I hardly ever write a letter. Before I used to